Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining in 1965, because it's our 50th episode, and Margaret was like, it's our 50th episode, let's talk about pop culture 50 years ago. Are...
It's just the way I think.
Winter Mitchell.
Hello.
Digital strategist Winter Mitchell.
Oh, that's right. Hello.
Hello. journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy. It's 1965.
Oh. Hello, Margaret. You're looking very mod in your little black mini dress.
Thank you.
An academic and DJ, Oliver Wang.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Oliver. How's it going?
Good. Well, I like your beard action going in.
Thank you. I have friendly chops now.
Yes.
Every week we start off the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture tastes. And you guys threw a lot of 1965 questions at us, but there were a lot of things that we were going to be talking about anyway. So we decided to answer really the biggest question of 1965. Who's your favorite Beatle? Oliver Wang, who's your favorite Beatle?
Normally, I would say McCartney just in the personality, but I went to look at, because I'm a nerd like that, I went to look at the two albums that the Beatles put out in 65, and I looked at the songs, and my favorite songs of those two albums were all written mostly by Lennon. So for 65, I got to go with John.
Okay, Margaret.
George Harrison. George Harrison is always my favorite Beatle because he is like a Still Waters Runs Deep type, and I like that type. And I also just think he was the most, like, spiritual. He was the one that led them, for instance, to India to, like, study with Ravi Shankar. And I think he's just the coolest one, like, hands down. I mean, I love Paul McCartney. I love John Lennon, who can't Ringo U2.
Oh,
but
no.
George, it's just my heart flutters for George.
Winter, favorite Beatle?
I like Paul McCartney. I just think that he's the one, of all of them, he really bought into sort of, like, the pop idleness,
yes,
of it all,
yes.
And he did it in a very Justin. It's, you know, Justin Timberlake has gone through the same thing, and Michael Jackson has gone through the same thing, where you just know who the star is, and he really embraced that.
Well, it was so interesting the like tension between the star and the artist, and
right.
Always kind of going to sympathize with the entertainer over the person who's taking themselves seriously.
Yeah,
and you gotta love him for giving Linda that tambourine and saying, "Hey, baby, we believe in you." As for me, Margaret Wappler, what was the likelihood I said that we had the same favorite Beatle?
I think you said approximately 70%.
Yeah, it's 100%.
Woo!
It's completely, whoa, George Harrison. Just because, like,
poor Ringo.
Once again.
There's poor Ringo, as always. I should like the Jewish one. But, like, I kind of respect George's solo career. I've Got My Mind Set on You as a good song.
Amazing.
It was, okay.
It was amazing.
He wrote some really good songs for the Beatles.
That Wah-Wah song, too, that whole album from the 70s. He
also
recovered well.
I respect all Traveling Wilburys in their way.
Yeah, I do, too.
But it was just like, you know, my sympathies always went to the guy that nobody was paying attention to who was doing good, solid work. Also, he produced like Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Like, he was... kept it going for a long time.
Man of many talents.
Sorry, Ringo.
Wait,
sorry,
there's another important question, though, of this era. The Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Okay.
Yes, because the Beatles had two albums as well, I think, right?
They were neck to neck at this time.
They were neck to neck, and Satisfaction came out this year, that year.
Oliver, Beatles or Stones?
Oh, it's tough because the Stones were a little bit ahead of the curve in 65 because,
yeah,
it wasn't until the end of the year that Rubber Soul comes out, and then the Beatles really enter into like the godlike Beatles stage.
Yeah.
But I was never a big Stones fan, so it doesn't matter. I'm still going to roll with the Beatles.
Margaret?
I think in this particular era, Rolling Stones.
Oh.
They just have a little bit more of the sexy, dirty edginess that I respond to.
I have to go with the Stones. The fact of here's the thing. They're still touring. Like,
yeah,
there's something just endearing and ever long about them. And I think the fact that they still feel the same soul they probably felt in 65, you know, 50 years later, I have to give it to
them. Well, Oliver, you weren't here for Paul Gilmartin's sort of evangelization about the wonder of the Stones.
Yeah.
But it really did. I think I have to go with the Stones because they're more fun.
Yeah, man.
However much, I mean, we all love the Beatles. All right. thanks to John, Paul, George, and Ringo for suggesting that question. Also, good luck in your finals to Sophie Geffros, who gave us a different question. we didn't answer. But still, good luck on your finals.
We can always bring it back another week.
We'll bring it back in future, Sophie. We love you. You're not going anywhere. Coming up on this week's show, it's our 50th episode, so we're skipping back 50 years and going to take a look at the pop culture of 1965. So to start us off, I'm going to have each of you tell me, instead of doing like what arts and entertainment you're all about this week, we're going to talk about the representation of 1965 you're all about this week. What's the meta 65 that you love, the window through which you were exposed to 1965 that you love? Oliver.
Well, you know, two of the things that immediately came to mind, we've already discussed to death in the show. So one would have been the movie Selma, right, which takes place largely in 65. And the other one we just talked about last week in our Spike Lee show, which was Malcolm X, because he was assassinated in 65. What I was curious about, especially coming from an L.A. context, was what movies had ever been made about the Watts riots. And off of my kind of ignorant, I haven't really thought about this deeply, I thought, I don't know if anything has been made. But thanks to the wonder that is Wikipedia, I found two. One of which doesn't really need to be spoken about extensively, but it came out in 94 and was called There Goes My Baby, which looks at the Watts riots, the night of the beginning of the riots, through a group of basically almost all white high school students at Westwood High School.
Because that's who I was wondering about.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's sort of one of those things like, why would you think to do this? But it was a coming of age sort of American, post-American graffiti-esque bite that had post-Silver Spoons, pre-NYPD Blue Rick Schroeder, pre-ER Noah Wiley, and mid-career Dermot Mulroney.
Dermot Mulroney!
Yes.
But it's such an interesting, that's so reflective of a screenwriter who's like, oh, hey, you want to know what would be an amazing backdrop? And sort of no sense of the Watts riots as anything but like geography.
Right. And there's one token African-American guy who's from Watts who has to go into the neighborhood to make sure his grandmother's okay.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's like completely white. I mean, it's West Side. It's completely white. So I didn't bother to do that much research on that show besides that. But there was a show from 1990. It was a made-for-television film called Heat Wave. That aired on TNT. And check out this cast. It had James Earl Jones, who ended up winning an Emmy for it.
I remember that.
Oh, you do? Okay. Yeah. Cicely Tyson, Blair Underwood, David Stratham. It completely missed my radar back in 1990. But when I checked out the trailer, maybe there's a reason why it missed my radar. And, Christian, do we have a clip from the trailer?
Yes, police won't be able to tell one black face from another.
Heat Wave. The Watts riots of 1965 turned the police into killers.
I said hold it right there!
The community into ashes.
I'm a real hawk.
It is the most 80s movie about the 60s ever.
Yeah, this whole music that's like, we can't even be bothered to go into music of the 60s. We'll just keep it with this like synth setting from the 80s.
Was it Jon Hammer who did the Miami Vice stuff?
We've really let a generation down between like 87 and 93.
I mean, but there is something so wonderful about the TV movies that basic cable was making before we paid attention to prestige television on basic cable.
Mm-hmm.
Because it really was a space where like, actresses over 45 and people of color would like maybe get a little bit of attention, and it, you know,
you got a lot of Emmys out of those scenarios.
Like Alfre Woodard was walking up and grabbing some Emmys and Golden Globes off of that shit.
That was like her whole like dominant force.
Well, there is something wonderful about those sort of like backdoor, side door things that you have to do to prove yourself to be ready when the real opportunities come. Margaret, what's the 65 that you're all about?
My 65 is The Outsiders. You know, the movie is delicious slumber party candy for sure, but I really want to talk more about the book because I read the book when I was in seventh grade and it totally blew my mind. It's one of the books that actually made me want to be a writer. It's so wonderfully done. It's so evocative of its time. It's weirdly violent and sweet, like that combination. Like the boys in the story are all so sweet to each other, even while they're like holding knives up to each other's necks. The main battle in the book and the movie is this conflict between the greasers and the socias. And I think as a kid, too, those kind of dynamics, those kind of fight, that kind of West Side Story element of, you know, kids being split down the line is so key to your understanding of what junior high and high school is like. So I think, you know, that book and the movie just really has this flavor to me of like the mid 60s. the hair, the jean jackets, the pop collars, like pre-80s pop collars, the original pop collars.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I love it. I just love the book and the movie.
It was also early in, the movie was early in our arc of 1980s, 1960s nostalgia.
Yes.
It was one of the like first moves there before we, it just saturated everything in 1987.
Right, right, because after that it was like Stand By Me and Dirty Dancing and all these other movies that, you know, were taking place in around the same time period. It really did usher in this big waterfall of 60s love.
Yeah.
Was The Outsiders, was that Swayze's big introduction?
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, he plays the oldest brother. He plays the brother that's trying to keep them all in line. And Soda Pop,
it's Ralph
the youngest Macchio, one.
Macchio's debut, though, right?
I think so. I mean, when you look back on that Francis Ford Coppola film, it's just studded with people.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
Tom Cruise, Matt Dillon.
Yeah, Leif Garrett, like just so many different people that...
Oh, Diane Lane.
Diane Lane.
Young Diane Lane.
Oh, God. Yeah. Yeah, she was...
Oh, actually, we have a moment to play from the movie that is Matt Dillon as a greaser trying to hit on Diane Lane, one of the socias.
Get your feet off my chair and shut your trap.
Who's going to make me, huh?
I'm going to get a cook.
Who, your boyfriend?
Leave her alone, gal.
Give me one, just gal. Just out of jail or something.
Yeah, sure, whatever you say, honey.
You better leave us alone or I'll call the cops.
Oh, my, my. You got me scared to death. What am I gonna do now, Pony? Huh? This girl's making me shake.
Why don't you leave us alone? You're nice and leave us alone.
I'm never nice.
I love it.
It's
delicious.
He was such a bad boy. What you guys don't know is that Matt Dillon, his character, had just gotten out of the cooler, as they say. And so he was really, living hard, living on
fire.
The edge.
Matt Dillon has an exceptional knowledge of Brazilian and Latin music records. He's
really?
A collector. Yeah.
Who would have thought?
And he shops it. The reason I know this is because he buys records from friends of mine. And
that's
crazy. Knows a ton about Latin and Brazilian records.
That makes me really like him even more.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
But he had that whole Dillon thing even back then.
Yeah.
Matt Dillon-ing back in the early days.
Winner, what 1965 are you all about?
There's a lot of things that I was really sort of passionate about. I actually just watched Get On Up this weekend with, and I it's so overlooked and, by the way, hugely underrated.
Oh, you liked it?
I loved it.
Oh,
I loved it. And I don't really usually like movies that go back and forth and jump around and don't really sort of stay in a timeline. It's not.
This is the James Brown biopic?
Yeah, the James Brown one that was by the guy who did The Help, who directed The Help.
Yeah.
And I found it really fascinating. James Brown was ridiculous in the best possible way. And I really loved that movie. It was really fantastic. If you haven't seen it, it's totally underrated. I don't know what was going on in the world that people missed this, but it was fantastic. But the one that I put down in the script was Bridges of Madison County, because I love that movie so much. And I read the book, and the book is great because I love the relationship between the brother and sister discovering these things about their parents. And I remember the first time I learned something about my mom and dad and realized they were human. But then also sort of like I've always really, really, really loved how delicate and quaint rural Midwest was back in that era. Just the idea that you did sort of the same thing every day. You went and got your meal. You prepared it. You took care of your kids. You washed clothes. And this is how women sort of lived their lives back then. So for a woman to decide to just have this adventure is so sexy. And it's just so, it was just, I
And she's a bit older, right? Like she's like 50, 60 something.
No, I think she was maybe more like 40s because she was an Italian war bride.
Okay.
So she so she was young.
But that was like 60 back in 1960.
Right, sure. Right. And I just like the idea that she had this tryst with this guy who made her see things and reminded her of the life that, and then the whole scene where she's like trying to get out of the car because she wants to, but 1965 is telling her you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, I just love that movie so much. It's so romantic. And I'm not even a softy like that.
But for me, the Good Morning Vietnam soundtrack was just such a primer on the music of the mid-60s. And my mom sort of like explaining to me the difference between the stuff that had happened. My mom graduated from high school in 1969, and so her sort of explaining like that Motown and stuff like that was like a little bit before her time, and then like how things change, and I just listen to that tape over and over again. And however hokey they may seem, those Robin Williams bits are really good. What a weird movie to make, though. What a strange movie that's kind of about Vietnam, but also about Robin Williams riffing, and it's another one of those tired stories about a nice white guy who chafes against authority but manages to break through it without anything terrible happening to him, and sort of cares about some Vietnamese people. But the songs on that tape were just so amazing and were just electrifying to me. Like, opening up the world of girl groups to me meant a lot.
So Big Chill versus Good Morning Vietnam soundtrack wins.
I mean, they're both very good, but I would give it to Good Morning Vietnam. But I brought this up, so I have to mention it. I am obsessed with the role of nostalgia-based compilation soundtracks in the 1980s, essentially from the Big Chill until the mid-90s when we had, like, the point when we got the musical back. I mean, younger people today may not remember it, but there was, when I was 13 years old, the notion of there being a musical film that people would go see was ridiculous. Those were a thing from the past. And we've, in an exciting way, gotten them back. But I don't precisely understand why those nostalgia-based, those movies almost were musicals. But why did that, take up all the space?
You mean in the 80s, the whole Big Chill, Dirty Dancing, you were saying,
Yeah. And as you said that, I kind of wonder if maybe Dirty Dancing isn't the 1965 I love. I'm not certain that it's 1965, but that ease.
It's definitely in the same era.
A rendering of the 60s.
I can tell you why.
Why?
Because MTV. Because we started having all this access to media that can make us look back, and a lot of the people that were on MTV were being heavily influenced by the music that they grew up with, which made people go backwards. I really feel like that sort of brought all of that back.
Well, it's also making me think that back then, that was the only way to rediscover music. Mm-hmm. You couldn't go online and just check out a compilation from 1965, which is what I did when I was trying to research the show. I could I had so much access to all this music, which made me really think about that in terms of the 80s. Like, we just didn't have that yet in place at all.
Well, as I was just buying stuff off of iTunes to be go through all of the Supremes and decide which I love most, realizing, in 1987, you were only exposed, as a child, was only exposed to the songs that media told me were important.
Yeah.
Like, those B-sides, unless you were sort of like a collector or something like that, it would have been, if it randomly came on the radio, maybe. But other than that, access was being curated for you.
By the way, Dirty Dancing 63, so very close.
It's close.
Close enough.
All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back to discuss the pop culture of 1965 after this break.
Welcome to Oh No, Ross and Carrie.
Ross.
Hi, Carrie.
What do you think is creepier?
Okay.
You jump into a swimming pool. All of a sudden, the water goes away, and instead of water, there is the bones of your dead ancestors.
Ew.
Or our show.
That's pretty tough, because we've visited a live exorcism.
We joined the Ordo Templi Orientis, where we had to worship a naked lady.
Oh, and we joined that Tony Alamo cult. No. They were scary.
Super creepy. We joined the Aetheria Society.
We tried penis enlargement, or at least I did.
Oh boy, I tried breast enlargement. We have basically done every creepy, weird, fringe thing except for thousands more, which we will get to if you listen to our show.
I'd still say the swimming pool with my ancestors' bones.
Well, then I don't even know if people should listen.
I guess they shouldn't.
But if you want to, we're at Maximum Fun, and the show's called Ono, Ross, and Carrie.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Who's in the studio with me?
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
Margaret, tell everybody why you decided to take us back 50 years.
Well, I think I wanted to go back 50 years because I looked at what year would be 50 years before 2015. I thought, 1965, that's a really interesting year, because things were definitely percolating, but it hadn't exploded into full-on psychedelic 1968-69 kind of madness yet. Like, it was all simmering under the surface. And that kind of energy really appeals to me, to, like, go back and look at that, partially because I feel like 1968, 69, 67 even, like, those have been really harvested for their cultural meaning. Like, we kind of all know the big touchstones of that, of those few years. But 1965 almost feels like a little lost in the slipstream of the 60s. Like, what is 1965? And when you go and look on Wikipedia and just look at the huge events that happened that year, you're like, holy shit, there was actually quite a bit going on.
Winner, give us some context for 65.
The cost of living in 1965. The average rent was $118. The average price of a house was $13,600. The average income was $6,450. And gas per gallon, are you ready?
No.
31 cents.
That's why they got those big gas guzzlers back then.
Yeah.
And 65 was the assassination of Malcolm X.
Right.
It was
Watts riots.
Watts riots break
out.
Civil
riots of 65. The voting act.
There's a civil rights act and
there's
a voting rights
act. And there's the immigration act, which is how my family got here. So,
and don't forget,
shout out to 65.
The Lyndon B. Johnson announced what I won't be able to use, Medicare.
And the Vietnam War was heating up.
Yeah.
And clearly making itself into a serious conflict and not just some dalliance we were going to have.
So we thought we would go through and just talk about each of us, bring up some stuff that from 65 that like meant a lot to us and we thought was great. I will start it off with, it is the first season of I Dream of Jeannie and the second season of Bewitched. And those shows to me were such a fascinating representation of post like the feminine mystique. Like feminism, like they're both very representative, like especially Bewitched. Bewitched is a stronger show, but it's both that kind of like suburban propriety that we got after World War II. And it's like really, it's set in stone now. We know what a man looks like, that he goes to a job and all of that. But then there's this subversive, wonderful force of a woman who can set everything upside down. And also this like deep sense of impropriety, that they have a neighbor who's constantly looking in trying to figure out what's wrong with them, but the thing that's wrong with them also makes them awesome,
right?
And that always made it a very gay show.
No, that's not what made Bewitched a gay show.
Well, a lot of things.
Paul Lynde made Bewitched.
I would say Elizabeth Montgomery did just as much to make it a gay show. Like, or fucking
Agnes Moorhead.
What's gayer than Agnes Moorhead?
Remind us of like what the concept of Bewitched was.
Okay, so Bewitched was just a family sitcom. It was like in the pilot, a couple gets married. And woman announces to her husband that she's a witch, and then her meddling mother shows up. And essentially every episode was, Endora casts a spell that somehow screws with Darren, and then, like, what's her name?
Elizabeth Montgomery.
Elizabeth Montgomery. What was her name? I forget.
Samantha
has to fix it. It's a pretty formulaic show, but having that kind of formula was so much fun. They had these great, like, old school vaudeville actors show up and play magnificent, gigantic aunts and uncles for Samantha, who were always screwing things up. And it was constantly just poking at the notion of patriarchy. It's always just like fucking with Darren.
And how crazy is it that they got two guys named Dick to play Darren, because they replaced Dick. They replaced Dick York with Dick Sargent.
Yes.
I'm assuming this was a contractual battle. And Dick York got pushed to the side.
The two Dicks.
I always thought he was the better of the Dicks.
Who? Which Dick?
Dick York, the first Dick.
It's a very popular opinion. I'm a Dick Sargent man.
I was okay with both Dicks.
I mean, just by the name Dick Sargent alone, I'm going to have to vote for him.
Dick Sargent.
But, like, I love the little outfits, and I love having that real sort of, like, strong vein of man in the gray flannel suit kind of, like, underscoring the show.
Well, I think in the 60s, and it shows up in music all the time, too, there was this real pervasive idea of women being, like, witches or magical or at the very least, like, the other. Like, they are capable of wreaking havoc and being highly mischievous and being these children that also have, like, sexual powers. And I think with I Dream of Jeannie, that is even more heightened and campy and ridiculous, where, like, she's calling him master, but then she constantly constantly pranks him, basically, and, like, has things go out of control. And
well, there's something so interesting about, like, in the late 40s, early 50s, you had this movie, I Married a Witch, but with Veronica Lake. And that's fundamentally about her needing to, like, give up being a witch, where Bewitched was always like, no, this bitch do... Like, she was renouncing her powers, but only for the sake of her relationship, and at any opportunity right. would completely use her powers.
I'm always surprised that Tabitha has not been a better baby name. Like, that was a good name. Like,
Tabitha is a cute name.
It needs to make a comeback.
It's a good name. Oliver, tell us about some 65 you love.
So, I mean, this is probably predictable, but I decided to look at the music of 1965. And by coincidence, there was a book that came out earlier this year by this guy, Andrew Grant Jackson, which is like the most presidential name ever. But he wrote a book called 1965, The Most Revolutionary Year in Music, where he argues that between things like Bob Dylan going electric and recording Like a Rolling Stone, the Beatles coming out with Rubber Soul, James Brown records basically the first real funk track, which is Papa's Got a Brand New Bag. You have the Supremes with Stop in the Name of Love. You mentioned earlier Martha and the Vandellas and Nowhere to Run. So all of these kind of, you know, epic, iconic songs came out. But really, 65 was never – I mean, I love music of the 60s. Anyone who knows me and has followed my stuff knows that I'm a big 60s guy. But 65 wasn't my year. It was really more towards the later end of the decade. My favorite songs of the year were not really the big chart hits. I mean, the number one song in 65, Woolly Bully by Sham and the Pharaohs, which is a perfectly decent song.
I love that song.
but maybe you heard it fresh. Part of the problem is that song has just been played so much.
It's on my
and
list.
So
we're
many
playing it later.
And commercials and movies and whatever that it's like
we're
dead
playing
to
it
me.
Later.
And novelty songs,
except for when Winter plays it.
novelty songs of that sort, like Who Let the Dogs Out. I'm sure that's the number one song of whatever year that is. You
that
know?
Is Who Let the Dogs Out of 1965.
There are some very. I mean, there are some unqualifiedly good songs at the top of the charts from 65. Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones being one of them. I mean, I was never a huge fan of You've Lost That Loving Feeling by the Righteous Brothers.
No,
but
me neither.
I was thinking about it. You're talking about the 80s and songs that looking back, and obviously, you know, Top Gun reintroduced that Righteous Brothers
There's
song.
There's a way that the Righteous Brothers and also the Eagles, to me, never ever felt like 60s or 70s music. They just feel like dad music from the 80s.
Yes.
You know?
Very much.
Really, Eagles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels so 70s to me.
But they're so dad rock, though.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, in any case. So I was ready to throw 65 a little bit out the window, not that far out the window. But then I started looking through my own record collection, and I tag years to a lot of the stuff I collect. So I just basically looked at everything that was from 65, and I realized that it was even if the songs at the top of the charts are not necessarily my favorites, a lot of the stuff that ran underneath that surface, especially a lot of the sweet soul kind of group harmony R&B from that era, are among some of my favorite songs of the decade. And so I prepped a Spotify playlist of about 20 of these songs
posted
for our listeners to check out. We'll put it in the show notes as well. And there are fantastic. I mean, there is just so many songs from 65 that I'm absolutely in love with.
Do you have something you want
to
play now?
Yeah. Let's listen to one that I think should be really familiar to any LA-based oldies fans, which is Eddie Holman's This Can't Be True. Inside, sweetheart.
Why do you love this?
I just love all the kind of male falsetto soul songs from this era, kind of the post-doo-wop, you know, sweet harmonizing. And, I mean, every year in the 60s had something that was in this vein, but 65 had, you know, great songs from The Impressions. You have, you know, this from Eddie Holman. I'm trying to think of what else I put on that list. The Van Dykes with No Man Is an Island. I mean, it's just a lot of this kind of sweet spot. I keep using the word sweet because it was such that era of that post-doo-wop sweet soul stuff. Just for me, as I get older, that becomes far more the kind of music I want to listen to.
When we were researching this, I immediately went for, oh, what was Dusty doing that year? What was Dusty doing? And the answer was transitioning.
Yep.
The answer was 1964, she was a Burt Bacharach machine.
Yeah.
And then 1966, she started transitioning into soul. And, like, this was that period of time when, like, I'm sure, I think she released some weird EP, but, like, it was between the big moments.
Mm-hmm. What, I mean, one last thing about the music from my point of view is I think this is true for probably any year, but I know we're going to talk about the movies of 65 at some point, and the music of 65 really captured what was going on, not just in that specific calendar year, but I think just the general vibe of what was happening in America and around the world in a way that I felt like the movies of that year were completely incongruous with that. And so I think it's another reason why I gravitate much more to the sounds of 65 than the movies, even though there are some incredible iconic movies that came out of the year.
Well, it's an interesting point because, like, we always we can forget about the studio system, but there was a real studio system still in place, getting ready to die, was gonna die.
And they were killing off people at this point. So there were people that had been like, and I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Oh, no, no, no.
There were people that were like instilled in the system from like the tail end of the 30s all through the 40s, were really comfortable in the 50s. And if you felt like it was your time to sort of take off, you did. And if you died off, you did. But if you were like kind of being told, you know, Joan Crawford, it's time.
Right.
Like you were unceremoniously asked to get, but you know.
There was that big machine that like right. did stuff like that. And it meant like reaction time on movies. The ability of movies to sort of like reflect
right.
the world was reduced.
Yes.
Yeah.
Winner, tell me about some 1965 you love.
Two things that
just do one now and we'll come back.
Okay. Joan Rivers made her debut on The Tonight Show
this
year.
Which is crazy.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
Yeah. Like, and I can't.
Why is that so
crazy?
Yeah,
why is that?
Because Joan Rivers was alive in 1965.
Yeah.
That's why.
No,
I mean, she was like a young babe at that point.
She was a young babe, and she killed it. She killed her set. And it was something that was, you know, at this point, Johnny Carson. I always think about NBC as one of those places when I was growing up thinking I wanted to work there, and I wanted to work there because it was such an institution
yeah.
based on what they created with the Today Show and the morning show and Sunday morning, and then also having the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And the fact that Johnny would sort of anoint people when he gave them the stage, and that Joan, I'm sure she must have been the first woman, right?
I mean, I think that there had been women before. I don't know if Toni Fields had ever done it. But
maybe
I mean,
not.
But
like,
she
and,
was
and,
also...
And
she
Anne
was
Mira,
a,
right?
She, I mean, Anne Mira, I think, is a little bit after. And she's also part of a comedy duo.
Right.
Like, Joan Rivers really was a shift in that she was much younger.
Right.
She was not this, like, super, super vaudeville performer.
Right,
or like
exactly.
Super, like, you know, old school club performer.
Right.
Like somebody like Toni Fields.
Right.
Or even Phyllis Diller.
Right.
And those early
sets. She was running with Pryor.
I mean, there's something so strange about how much, this is a Caucasian woman, a relatively attractive Caucasian woman.
Right.
And the amount that she needed to explain herself.
Right.
To an audience, that she needed to explain how much trouble she was having finding a man.
Right.
That she needed to, like, she mentioned that she was from Larchmont so heavily, just so that you wouldn't think she was the wrong kind of Jew. You know? Like, just to sort of say, no, we got to the suburbs, motherfucker. We're doing fine. Like, it is amazing to see her on Ed Sullivan or The Tonight Show.
It's just fascinating to think that that whole entire, and I don't even know if this is like the Laugh-In era, but it was just those things. Even when I was a little kid, I was so drawn to, because I always was drawn to people that were doing the opposite of what I was made told I was being programmed,
yeah.
you know, to watch and be interested in. It's the same reason why I could never watch cartoons that were like a little bit more modernized. And Tom and Jerry debuted that year as well, 1965. And I'm just have this like total longing, and I always have a connection to like the Hanna-Barbera, Warner Brothers era of cartoons, because it was way less than, I feel more about that than I feel about Disney, because it really talked about what was happening in the world. It was sort of like the propaganda that was being sort of created all over the world about America.
Yeah.
It was us kind of being like, yeah, we get it, but we can actually make it. So we'll distribute it. So I really, I'm fascinated by this year, because there was a lot of, I don't know, American propaganda that was sort of being created and stirred about, so we can kind of forget about how terrible things were going in
yeah.
the actual world itself.
Margaret, what's something 65 you love?
Well, like Oliver, I really found that the music in particular felt really potent and alive to me, in a sense that the movies didn't quite. Just even when I looked at what were the Oscar nominees for that year, I mean, Dr. Zhivago is not taking place in 1965, so it seems like, you know, some other thing. And then My Fair Lady, Sound of Music. I mean, Sound of Music obviously was this machine that, like, took over the year and filmed that,
right.
that year, but... What were you going to say?
Oh, I mean, the thing is one of the things I specifically put down is I actually think that 1965 in film is very fascinating. And basically, Sound of Music and Pawnbroker, I feel like, are such fascinatingly different ways of dealing with World War II after it happened. Mm. Like, it's 20 years later, and we've Marshall Planned the fuck out of Europe, and we're having – these are our closest allies in the Cold War. And it is so fascinating to have this movie that is fundamentally a – propaganda picture about how they weren't all bad. And it's a lovely movie. Every fucking number is good.
Mm-hmm.
But it does an interesting job of, after we rehabilitated the actual Germany, we went and we rehabilitated the folklore Germany through Austria, but still. But then, like, the other side of that is, have any of you here seen The Pawnbroker?
No.
Okay, Pawnbroker is an amazing film. I think it got a notoriously bad rating because there's a moment where you see a black woman's breasts. And the story is basically...
Which is amazing.
Yes. The story is a Holocaust survivor, so somebody who sort of like... It's so weird to think about the 50s and 60s and realize that they were just like people who had lived as adults through the Holocaust... Now just, like, in Ohio. But this is a guy living, like, I believe he's, like, lives with his niece and nephew on Long Island. And he runs a pawn shop in, like, the ghetto. Like, in, like, Harlem, I think, or Brooklyn. And it is this person sort of, like, dealing with PTSD, basically, from having been through the Holocaust. But in this world that is a different kind of... torture for a group of people, mm-hmm. and it is a fascinating, amazing movie. Rod Steiger plays the main character.
Oh, amazing.
And he didn't win an Academy Award because it was too much for everybody, and then 2 years later they gave it to him for
In the Heat of the Night
because that was exactly the kind of civil rights movie we were figuring out how to make then,
right.
And we've all heard me rant about how America is too good at making a pat civil rights movie, but like The Pawnbroker to me is sort of like also this step towards danger, like psychological danger that was starting to happen in movies, that you were moving towards stuff like The Graduate and things that would make you, that would be unsettling.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring up that the one movie that I watched from 1965, Darling by John Schlesinger,
yes.
that I know you've watched.
Okay, and if you're a gay guy out there and you yes. haven't watched Darling yet... Turn this podcast off. Keep going.
and watch it. Because it's pretty fascinating in its depiction of a woman in 1965 who is living the kind of life. By the way, this woman is played by Julie Christie. And Julie Christie was having a damn good year in 1965.
I love the thing where an actress just like pops through in 1 year. Like Jessica Chastain a couple of years ago, like, you know, had three amazing movies and Coriolanus to boot.
Yeah.
But keep going.
So Julie Christie is playing this model who is living this kind of like deliriously modish, debaucherous life where she loves to drink and party. And first she hooks up with this intense writer fellow. They move in together. He leaves his wife. She
yes,
leaves
I've
her
seen
husband.
This.
They move in. You know that they're pretty in love, but at the same time, like, she
yeah.
just can't get her shit straight
it's
yet.
It's not enough.
It's yeah. not enough. She still has to be a wild girl.
Yes.
She still has to be a wild child. So she goes out there uh-huh. on one of her other modeling jobs, and she meets this other fellow who's
yep.
much more of a party man than this writer guy she's with. And so she just, like, flits off to Paris with him and eventually meets this Italian prince. And I don't want to ruin the movie for you. Things happen anyway. But... It's a character that, this is the thing that fascinated me about Darling, is that the character is not really that likable. Like she's kind of petty. She's mean. She's vindictive. She's sort of like, she's just so shallow that you're like, Jesus Christ, recognize the decisions in your life. But she is also, you know, relatable and human and lives this kind of life that if a man had lived it, she would not be facing the same punishments that she faces in this movie.
Yeah.
That eventually come down the pike.
The reason why I like this movie, I forgot I'd seen it, is that we have been plied so much through this era in cinema with women being
Julie Andrews in Sound of Music.
But if they were
or Mary Poppins.
No, but if they were like her, they were vindictive, they were villains, and they were positioned as villains. They were murderers, they knew as had a secret, they were thieves, psycho. But then when a woman was like everything that you wanted her to be, the wife, the happy homemaker, that was like presenting like this whole industry. Like that was the economy to be that type of woman. Like you want it to be that type of woman. So then this movie comes out and it's totally all of that new wave French shit, but
yes,
in America.
It's a total like ripoff. It's a total like Godard and like Antonioni,
yes, exactly,
like jump cuts. Yes.
Exactly. And so then you get this movie where she's just like, no, I'm not into this. No, not into that. It's sort of like presented like this modern woman that I don't think people knew that they were going to get no matter what, but they didn't realize that they were, A, they existed and this is what it was about to be. That's why I love that movie. I forgot I saw it.
It's such an interesting swirl of like a little bit of feminism and a little bit of like British invasion swinging 60s kind of thing. But then also with kind of that like, we knew how to make a Tennessee Williams movie. We knew how to make like a psychological drama where you judge somebody. And it sort of brings all of that. But there is the way that she's just so gorgeous that it's charismatic.
You know,
go ahead.
I was going to say that I went and read the Pauline Kael review of the movie.
Oh, and also, again, I feel like I'm just always speaking to the 20-year-olds out there. But if you watch an old movie, see if Pauline Kael reviewed it, because you're not going to agree with her, but you're going to read some amazing thoughts by a batshit crazy lady.
So yeah, Pauline Kael, at that time, the main film critic for The New Yorker, she wrote about it. And it's amazing because, she hates it. She's like, oh, this is just a trifle of a film that thinks it's deep and it's not deep. And, you know, it basically functions like a baddie magazine profile that never goes anywhere.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, reading this, I respect Pauline Kael and I do find her criticism really, you know, insightful most of the time. But I have to say, reading this, I was like, maybe this movie in 1965 just had a completely different impact than now. Because seeing it now, to me, I was like, wow, I didn't even know that there could be like an unlikable woman on screen back then.
And it is very much a movie for a post-Kardashians world. Like, it is...
Are we post-Kardashians?
Well, we're solidly in the Kardashians, but it's essentially this girl who, like, wills her way to being a celebutante.
Right.
And it judges her for it, but it's also kind of great. I will talk about the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yes!
I love...
By the way, it was his 90th birthday yesterday. Can we just
really
bow the fuck down?
Let's have some goddamn respect.
Thank you.
Wow, 90.
All right.
Still killing it. Not like frail. He's like...
Still making like dog food or something?
He's running like a mile a day.
Oh, okay. Here's my favorite thing about Dick Van Dyke. In the 70s, CBS signed him to like a thing. They were like, we want you to make a sitcom. But he lived in Phoenix. And was like, I will not leave Phoenix. And they, instead of saying, all right, well, you're violating your contract, they just built a studio in Phoenix.
Yeah.
And they made a sitcom for 3 seasons in Phoenix.
Yeah.
And I always, anytime it would come on in syndication, I was like, this is ridiculous. But Real Dick Van Dyke Show, I love a good multicam sitcom. And it is weird that, like, that early in television, we had meta-television about making television.
Mm-hmm.
But it also was the original 30 Rock. It was the original Muppet Show. Like, it established that rubric for the show behind the show. It's so much something that, like, I, every day during the summertime, like, our local station played The Dick Van Dyke Show at 12 and 12:30, and I had to go out and play in the orchard until 12, could come inside, have my lunch with my mom for those 2.5 hours, and then had to go back and play in the orchard some more. But Dick Van Dyke Show is an amazingly well-produced sitcom, but also occupies a fascinating space in the mainstreaming of Jews in America, in that it was originally produced as a vehicle for Carl Reiner. It was originally starred Carl Reiner and had a woman playing his wife who I don't know if she was like actually Jewish. She just wasn't Mary Tyler Moore. And they showed it to the network and the network was like, no. And that's where the old saw, write Yiddish, act British, came from. Or write British, cast Yiddish, cast British. But they hired Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore to take over. And it was such a like suburban New York show, and it had Maury Amsterdam on the show, sort of like I remember my mom, like us living in a town without many Jews. My mom sort of like explaining like Maury Amsterdam, Carl Reiner, who of course recurred as the star of the show within a show, and my mom sort of like explaining like that guy wrote that show. He's where all the funny comes from. This is a show about his family.
Right.
He just had to, like, put it through this, like, waspy prism. But I fucking love that waspy prison. Like, coming from kind of, like, a rural working class family, having this look into, like, what the middle class looked like was fascinating. And my mom had a weird relationship with it because her family was, like, poor. And that they did not watch any of those terrible 60s sitcoms that just talked about how everything was fine. They didn't watch the Donna Reed Show. But the Dick Van Dyke Show was so goddamn funny that they did watch it. And I love that show.
So random Dick Van Dyke thing is, so 65 was the year that Mary Poppins won big at the Academy Awards, even though the movie itself came out in 64. And I probably watched it as a kid and didn't really pay that much attention to it besides like the flying umbrella thing. But when Ella was younger, she really loved, and because Sharon loves Mary Poppins, and so I was rewatching with her, and I never picked up on the sort of subtle romantic slash sexual tension between Dick Van Dyke's character and Julie Andrews' Mary Poppins.
It's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, because you kind of like, oh, they...
You didn't pick up on that? It was searing through the screen.
As a kid, I wasn't paying... That didn't happen to me when I was like 8 years old, but when I'm like... In my 40s, I'm like, oh my god, they totally did it at one point. You know?
Can I tell the story of the glorious, like,
probably on a roof when it was raining?
Oh, yeah,
and they had umbrellas over them.
Got soot everywhere. I know I've been talking a lot. Let me tell the story of the glorious dust up of Best Actress in 1965. Okay,
go in, son.
All right, so Julie Andrews. She, like, her first starring role on Broadway was in My Fair Lady. She fucking killed it left and right. It made her a star. Everybody fell in love with her. Of course, Warner bought My Fair Lady. They were going to make it into a movie. Everybody was like, you're going to guess Julie Andrews, right? And, whatever Warner was in charge of Warner Brothers was essentially like...
One of the brothers.
She's not pretty enough. Which is a thing that happened left and right back in those days. They were like, she's not pretty enough. We're casting Audrey Hepburn, who had like this kick-ass year in, was it 1963, with like Roman Holiday and stuff. And she was the bright new thing. So they cast Audrey Hepburn. She sang. They realized her singing wasn't strong enough. They dubbed her with Marnie Nixon. And it was one of those situations where like everybody knew the story and wanted to hate that movie. Though it's a perfectly fine movie and the only movie that George Cukor won Best Picture for. But Disney cast Julie Andrews in The Sound of Music, in Mary Poppins, and she, of course, slid in, won the Academy Award, and then the next year lost the Academy Award to Julie Christie for Darling when she was in The Sound of Music.
No, Dr. Zhivago, I think.
She won for Darling.
She did.
Yeah.
Oh, nice work, Julie Christie.
It was a good era for Julie's and Dick's. Yeah. Julie's and Dick's.
Do you know what? By the way, just to jump ahead, the same thing happened to Stephanie Mills and Diana Ross with The Wiz, I read.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Diana Ross basically told Berry Gordy, I'm going to be Dorothy, and you're not casting Stephanie Mills, and then went to the studio and told the studio, this is why you're casting me, I can get Michael Jackson, and told Michael, you say no if they try to go around me, and they went, tried to go around him, and then he was like, I'm not doing it with Diana. Cock blockers.
He said, I'm not doing it without Diana?
No, they ended up both doing it, and it tanked.
He's still amazing at it.
Right.
All right. The best story of they're not casting the person from Broadway was born yesterday when Louis B. Mayer called Judy Holliday that fat Jew bitch.
Louis Mayer, such a way with words, yes. Such tact.
But Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy made the movie Adam's Rib just to show off Judy Holliday in that movie.
I'm love them.
Sorry I told 1,000 Oscar stories and Winter told one. Tell us about some music.
Okay. So when I was looking at 1965, there's some really obvious albums of the year, like Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, which I love and, you know, still play pretty frequently. But I really wanted to dig down a little deeper into 1965 and look at the artists that, like, I know a little bit about, but maybe I don't know this particular song. So I was actually looking at what the Billboard hits were, every single hit of 1965. And most of the songs that are on this list that I put together are Billboard hits, although a couple of them are not. But it was just fascinating to look at that Billboard list because basically there were like three or four dominant strains of 1965 in terms of the music hits. So there was like folk music, there was like Donovan and the Turtles and the Zombies, and obviously that, you know, bridges over into the British invasion bands, the Who, Rolling Stones, so forth. Then there was also, like, obviously Motown, like Marvin Gaye, huge year for him. He's just killing it with, like, Ain't That Peculiar, and what other Marvin Gaye songs?
Doggone.
Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You, right?
Yeah.
Is that 65?
I'm pretty sure that's 65.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously he was having a huge year, so Motown is this huge strain. But then there's also, like, the 50s crooners that are left over and still kind of rattling around on the charts. Like, Frank Sinatra still is coming around here and there. Like, Dean Martin actually was really had some songs going on.
I was surprised I saw no Elvis presence.
There was a few Elvis.
Elvis Now.
Oh, really? I don't know what's on that.
Elvis, I don't know what's on that.
But it definitely wasn't his year. You know what I mean? Like, he was not, like, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, all the stuff that you think of as the 50s was definitely being passed
like,
by.
Being passed like, people by. Were the Beach like Boys.
Over it. Yeah, the Beach Boys were coming up.
Yes.
They were on their come up.
While I was looking through, I was sort of like, God, in 1965, how much would I have been about the Supremes? But also kind of realizing, like, the Supremes who I really love don't happen until 1967,
Well, that's the thing, too, is, like, with a lot of the rock bands, like, the Zombies, for instance, like a year or two later would have The Oracle and The Odyssey, and that's, like, this great psychedelic album, but it's not happening yet, you know? They're still, like, they're still getting it together. You can listen to the music and hear these fleeting moments of the psychedelic sound, but it's just not there yet. But the other strain that was also happening was this amazing girl group strain, which I think we've touched on a little bit. But, like, in particular, the Shangri-Las, like, were just killing it with Leader of the Pack and, you know, all sorts of songs that just came at the girl group thing with this, like, darkness, this, like, teenage melodrama, which, you know, Meatloaf would later on carry away with.
Leader of the Pack was 65?
Yeah. They were already that big in 65.
I kind of love that.
But that sounds like such an early 60s song. Like, I have... Anyways, okay. Wow.
But, you know, I mean, I do think 65 still had that sound. You know what I mean? It still had those kind of harmonies.
Sure.
But I feel like 65 is one of those years where we always consider, like... Especially with my parents, they always say 68 was a transitional year, 63 was a transitional year after Kennedy died. But there was something about, just doing the research, there was something about how I think the world was starting to, at least America at the very least, was starting to sort of be cognizant to the fact that they were being channeled things that they didn't necessarily have to accept.
How do you mean?
Yeah.
I think, I mean, like, they were being, you know, television was relatively new at this point.
Uh-huh.
And sort of the notion that you would go and see, like, a film. You went to the picture show. You didn't go to see movies. So a lot of things were becoming visual and visible. So they were able to sort of start looking at themselves against others and either accepting like what it was supposed to be about or totally rejecting it. That's how I feel like you get to the 70s, which are so completely different than everything that was happening in the last 30 years prior.
You have color showing up a lot more popularly. I think 66 is the last year that they award separate Academy Awards for black and white. And you also have a lot more filming on location as opposed to, like, you leave sort of like those stagey sets.
Yes, yes. And that's sort of like, you know, television was so powerful at that point. It really helped make a difference in so many different ways. But then I think there was a point where people were just like, what's the frequency, Kenneth? Like, what am I being programmed to understand when I don't really necessarily give a shit?
I mean, the thing of the baby boomers turning like
15, 16
yeah. and starting to like question the world around them.
Yes, exactly.
That they had lived in this TV world for their entire lives.
Exactly.
And then they became terrible and made the 80s for us.
Thank you for that, Mom and Dad.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I was going to play like a few snatches of a few different songs.
Let's hear it.
Yeah. So starting with the Staples Singer, this is just one of these songs, Freedom Highway, that was recorded in this church in Chicago and really has this feeling of being, I mean, hugely informed and influential to the civil rights movement at the time. I can't understand my friend, why some folks think freedom is not designed for old men. There are so many. And of course, that's Mavis Staples in there taking the lead. And we remember from the movie Selma that, you know, she had these beautiful moments of singing on the phone to Martin Luther King when he needed like some reinforcement. So it just like has that very like visceral, alive, like in the moment feeling. Like I really like when you listen to the whole album, you really do feel like you're in the South Side of Chicago, like
yeah.
present at that time with those people, like feeling the real blues of it too. Like there's blues and gospel that's just threading throughout that whole album. And unlike a lot of the blues that was happening in the British invasion side of things, it feels much more authentic. Whereas yeah. like the British invasion, like the Who, I mean, I love the Who, but it's like, it's much more of a pose. It's much, right. much more of a posture.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then I wanted to play a little bit of Donovan's The Universal Soldier, because this is one of the songs that was a big hit of that year, and especially in Britain was a big hit, and is one of the big protest songs of the era and would kind of come in and out of style throughout the 60s. And, you know, has this message that to me is actually dated in an interesting way, because he puts the onus of war on the individual soldier, basically saying, like, you know, this guy kind of picks up a weapon and just does whatever he's told. And I think we've become in a way more sophisticated in talking about war yeah. protests, and we don't sort of put that blame anymore. But here's the Universal Soldier.
Fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's...
Donovan had an album at this year called Fairy Tale, which is actually really excellent, and a lot of the songs have that kind of like really pure folky element to it. And it wasn't for a couple more years that he would get into like the mellow yellow, you know, super trippy, sucking in on the reefer vibe that we all know him as.
Like, the high Cold War is so fascinating because the relationship between like the communist bloc and the Western bloc. On the one hand, there's so much integration of the other side's mentality. There is, like, we're throwing up all of these brutalist buildings. Like, we are, like, in that song, it's so suffused with this notion that, like, the revolution comes from within and it will be changed by individual people, like, you know.
Protesting.
Protesting.
Which is valuable, but at the same time, it's more complicated, of
but
course.
But it is so weird, too. There's that big statue of Lenin's head on La Brea. And every time I pass it, I am reminded of the fact that we could not have done that during the Cold War, because we took it seriously, and like explicit imagery like that was impossible. While at the same time, we in our guts were semi-certain that you have to give them a little bit of socialism or else they'll just go completely communist.
It's well, so funny that you even say that, that Lenin's head is on La Brea next to a furniture store of a store that sells garden tools in a Walgreens.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny you mentioned the Cold War, because I also was thinking about back to television of 65, that this is the year that Get Smart debuts, mm-hmm. I Spy debuts in 65, uh-huh. The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And obviously behind all of this is also the beginning successes of the James Bond, the Bond franchise, right. which begins a few years before that.
And John le Carré's novels.
Right.
The Spy Who Came in from the Cold was a huge book.
And so this, I feel like this is the era in which the Cold War becomes very stylish as well, and that it becomes yeah. fodder for mockery in the case of Get Smart and yeah. I Spy.
Also, let's take a moment to talk in this very weird time about how do we talk about I Spy? Like, it's the first show, I believe, with a black lead on primetime television, and that's a wonderful mark in history, and the fact that the man who did it is terrible, like, shouldn't take away from that as...
This is Bill Cosby, in case anyone's never seen I Spy.
I mean, I can't... You can't take away what the contribution was.
Yeah.
And the intentions... Ugh. I mean, you can even say call it that at this point. The intentions, I don't know. I can't even say anything.
It's bigger than one person.
It's bigger than one person.
Yeah.
I want to be like, yay, but can't even say that.
But it was a, you're right. It did sort of make, because things were getting high tech in the Cold War,
right.
Suddenly it was cool to be a participant in that. There was something slick about it. And it was also, we didn't really talk about it, but just the glut of war movies that were, like, floating through the system at this point in time. And, like, I guess dads liked it because they were in World War II or Korea and kind of remembered that.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I think there's much more of a tradition of reverence going on at the time.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this...
Except for Gomer Pyle, but,
The song that I'm going to play in a minute, Eve of Destruction, I mean, when this song got popular, there were all these counter songs that were sort of like, no, it's not Eve of Destruction. The things that we're doing with war are good. And, you know, there was that kind of blowback. And that's why it was such an intense time, too, is because, you know, there were these wars that were much more recent in history and much more staggering in their effect. I mean, with Korea and World War II, I mean, World War II, huge. I mean, just this incredible conflict of our time. And so I feel like, you know, that was, in essence, what people were getting so offended by, too, with Vietnam.
Yeah.
Like, why are you denigrating the whole effort of being a soldier in the first place?
Because it is, like, it is questioning the sacrifice I made at Normandy or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
Let's hear Eve of Destruction.
Over and over and over again, my friend. You don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
So this is the Turtles version of it, and it goes from, you know, talking about Vietnam and war, and it also name checks Selma and what's going on in Alabama at the time, which is interesting that this particular song, like, spans both this, like, kind of world conflicts and the conflicts going on in the country. And, you know, one of the other people of that year, this is also interesting about 1965, is that there were many songs that, like, many different people did versions of, you know, which I don't think happens as much anymore. It's like three or four artists will sort of grab onto a song and make their own version. I mean, Bob Dylan's songs were being constantly covered in that era. But this is the Turtles version. But the guy who got actually more popular with this version was a guy named Barry McGuire, who, you know, became a born-again Christian eventually and stopped playing this song because it felt so hurtful to him to sort of talk about war as this non-Christian activity.
I'm sorry, like...
Shouldn't
talking about war as the eve of destruction be the most Christian sentiment?
I know, absolutely. And apparently he has resuscitated the song and plays it again.
Because he needs that check.
Probably.
He needs that check. Above all else.
So, I mean, just on a pure, I was talking about the zombies earlier with the Oracle and the Odyssey, and, like, I love the zombies. I feel like they're one of those bands of that time that don't get that much attention. Like, we all know about the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and the Kinks, and, like, those are all great, but the zombies are wonderful. And this is a song I just wanted to slip in here called Tell Her No.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. And if she tempts you with a charm,
sound like really sophisticated for the time, like that the melodic sensibility in that song
there.
I mean, there's some jazz song. kind of beat to it. There's like a whole layering of the melody. It's really gorgeous. So transitioning now into a few girl group songs, I want to play the Shangri-Las, I Can Never Go Home Anymore. I was going to play Leader of the Pack, which, of course, is awesome, but I Can Never Go Home Anymore actually gets at the extreme melodrama that the Shangri-Las channeled more.
But only my girlish pride And that's called bad.
Never go home anymore. The Shangri-Las were such downers back then, man. Jesus Christ.
Now, if that's happened to you, don't let this. I packed my clothes and left home that night. Though she begged me to stay, I was sure I was right.
This is about her mom begging her to stay. But I feel like the thing about the Shangri-Las is that they're like a polar opposite to like the bad boy Rolling Stones.
Uh-huh.
Like the Rolling Stones are all about singing about breaking girls' hearts and crushing them under their thumbs and so forth. And the Shangri-Las were like the victims.
The ones getting crushed under the thumbs.
Yes, exactly.
The best Gilda Radner sketch in Gilda Live is her doing her mid-60s girl group. But she's like a super Long Island Jap. It's Rhonda Weiss and the Rondettes. And she does one of those mournful I Was Done Wrong songs.
Yes.
About the FDA making saccharin unavailable. It is one of the sort of best Jap jokes. But there was this weird period of time when it was like, five girls from Philly would go and do like a talent show, and then they would get signed to the local like record label, and then that would go national. And like you had some like assembling of girl groups and stuff, but how much it was just sort of like every town in the Northeast had like one girl group who was doing well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the girl groups at that point too could offer you sort of like every kind of experience in the girl group lexicon. You know what I mean? There was like the wounded girls of Shangri-Las, but then there were also just these super up, like bouncy
the Supremes.
Yeah, right. The Supremes, yeah. Exactly.
Martha Mandela's.
The next one I want to play is the Ronettes, and this is a song called "Born to Be Together." And this has such a Phil Spector crazy drum vibe. Ronnie Spector, like a year later, would basically be trapped in a closet by Phil Spector. But at this point, she's still making music. Her powerful voice is just blowing so strong in the song, and the drums are just this complete, like, primal beat behind her. The thing I love about the Ronettes, too, is they always feel like this real lost document of the 60s.
Yeah.
Like that they were, I mean, obviously there were these interpersonal dimensions between Ronnie and Phil, but there's also this sense that for a long time they just got forgotten, you know?
I mean,
completely like collapsed.
During that period of time that we were re-releasing all of that stuff from the 60s, Phil Spector, I believe, still had partial ownership of Ronnie's music,
yeah.
And specifically to spite her was not allowing this music to be on soundtracks or be in those compilation albums that you would like see on TV, and that screwed her over real hard. For those of you who don't know, producer Phil Spector and Ronnie Spector, the leader of the Ronettes, were in a relationship. He was very violent with her. As we learned, he is with many women. They had a terrible, terrible breakup.
The next song I want to play is Dionne Warwick's You Can Have Him. This is when she's working with Burt Bacharach. She's like one of my favorite voices of this era because I think, too, when I first learned about Dionne Warwick, it was in the 80s and she was like on that Psychic Hotline commercial,
yes,
all the time. And I was like, who is this woman and what is she about? And I had no idea. And then at some point I backtracked and actually listened to the music and I was like, dear God, she's a revelation. How did she end up on the Psychic Hotline? I don't know.
That era of interpreters of songs, that you would have these songs come out and then Dionne would do her version and Dusty would do her version. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful. Let's hear it.
So also has that big band sound, you know, that's still coming off of like the 40s and the 50s and being carried over into this really like pastel-y 60s sensibility.
But the drums.
Yeah.
Oliver was finger drumming, you guys.
It was. I mean, it has such aggressive drumming for a song of for a pre-funk era song. Like, yeah. It's really pretty extraordinary.
Mm-hmm. No, that is kind of like a funkier Dionne Warwick than I've been exposed to in the past.
I know,
she,
right?
She had a little moment, but not until like, you know, 68, 69.
The last song I want to play because this song of all the songs really made me feel like I was in 1965, like sitting in a park, like waiting, watching the people. This is Billy Stewart. And Billy Stewart eventually became famous for doing this sort of like super scatting style. And this song doesn't really have so much of that. It really has more of that like doo-wop, like male falsetto voice, but it's gorgeous.
Wondering if you ever gonna show up. I don't know if you're gonna show. My darling, I got to go. But nevertheless, I said, you gotta be waiting, sitting.
Real mid-60s.
I know, right? Don't you just feel it? Like, I feel like I'm shopping in a department store with, like, my hair and, like, a flip.
It's pretty great. Well, that was our look at 1965. We'll be right back to give you our jams from 1965 right after this. You're listening to Pop Rocket.
Hey, you like t-shirts, right? How about a mug? Are your walls looking a little bare? Visit MaxFunStore.com and cover all of these bases and more. We just added some amazing new shirts and posters, so visit today and outfit your home and torso with the freshest MaxFun merch. MaxFunStore.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And we are taking, as this is our 50th episode, we are taking a look back at the year 1965 and the pop culture from that year. So normally we ask the question, what's your current jam? But, Winter Mitchell, what is your 1965 jam?
I kind of have two. Sorry. The first one is Wooly Wooly by Sam the Sham in the Pharaohs.
Let's hear it.
I need a toga on,
I
need to be spilling beer all over my hairy body because I'm John Belushi all of a sudden.
A pop culture thing we didn't talk about that we should have talked about was the dance culture of the mid-60s.
Oh, my God.
Really was that golden period of having, like, specific named dances.
Yes.
And all of us as sort of, like, Gen Xers with baby boomer parents, I don't know how old your parents are, but, like, that ritual of, like, was a little gay boy, my mom teaching me the pony and the mashed potatoes and
the mashed
stuff like
potatoes.
That.
Potatoes.
And I was like, this is a skill I'm going to need. At some point in time, I'm going to have to do the mashed potatoes.
I always thought I was really good at all those dances. I studied them so hard. The second one is my dad loves this band. And I was always, I remember being surprised, you know, because black people, when I was a little kid, black people only like black people stuff. But when my dad told me that his two favorite bands that he would always go check out when he was in Los Angeles as a teenager and then back in San Francisco. One was the Doors. The other one was the Beach Boys. He can go on and on and on about the Beach Boys, how much he loves them as a band and why he really loved their sound. And California Girls, this isn't my favorite Beach Boys song. My favorite Beach Boys song is Caroline No. And so the California Girls is the song from the 65, though.
And the Southern girls with the way they talk, they knock me out when I'm down there.
California girls.
Daughters really make you feel alright. And the Northern
Oliver,
girls with the
what is the best diss track on the White Album?
The what the
diss track?
The best diss track on the like the Beatles' White Album?
Yes. What is the best diss track on the White Album?
Did they take a shot at the Beach Boys on that album?
Back in the USSR, it took me forever to realize it opens up as a like essentially a parody of California Girls.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's
you
all
mean
right.
With that jet landing sound?
No, because like they then go into it and they're talking about how.
In from Miami Beach way away.
Are you sure it's not an homage?
No, like it's clearly making like I always took it because they're talking about the Georgian girls and stuff like that. Like I a couple of years ago I was listening to it and I was like, oh, they're shitting.
I don't know about
all
that.
Right, I gotta re-listen
the
to this.
Had a lot of respect for the Beach.
I mean, yeah,
both
I'd be surprised.
Had a lot
if
of respect
for right.
that era.
Well, look,
but I did watch the 6-hour miniseries and there was some.
W.S. Gilbert and Oscar Wilde had a lot of respect for each other, but they also shit on each other in their plays.
Okay.
That's
okay.
What you do sometimes when you respect somebody.
Okay.
I mean, I shit on you all the time, guy.
No, but Brian always felt, but Brian was, his position was, he was too in his head and on and high to really go there. It was always about topping himself.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
I mean, that happens to great artists so much,
yeah.
And it destroys them so frequently.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, with California Girls, it's one of those, especially in the Beach Boys, a lot of their songs was like this, where the kind of the verses were really kind of meh, but the hook.
Right.
The
yeah.
hook
but
on
I
that
think
song
they
was
knew
so amazing.
That.
Oh, yeah.
Think
I mean,
they
you
knew
couldn't
that.
Take that song too seriously.
They all worked against their own, like, what's the word I'm looking for? They worked against their own... What
best interests?
No, they worked. Whoever was not strong at something.
Oh,
somebody
they worked
else
against their weaknesses.
They worked
yeah.
against their weaknesses right. and produced amazing music.
They really are the glorious story of that one sort of like genre group that managed to like transcend and make Pet Sounds and
but then
like
but then kind of go back to like and then Kokomo. So it's sort of, you know, up and down.
Hey,
Kokomo's an amazing
Kokomo.
Song.
You want that Kokomo money.
Makes
you
me
know you
want to have a daiquiri.
Margaret, what is your 1965 jam?
I had to go with Tom Jones. Because when I was looking through the hits, I just thought, wow, this is a song that I just didn't realize was made in 1965. I mean, obviously I knew it was sometime around that era.
Yeah.
But it really shocked me that it was 1965. And the thing that I like about it so much that I was thinking about is that it's really an amalgamation of all these different influences of the time. It's like this big band sound. It's this jazzy sound. It has that sort of like Dean Martin, old crooner vibe a little bit, but then just brought into the swinging 60s, full-blown mod party vibe. So let's hear a little bit of that. It's not unusual to see me cry. Fucking way you can hear this song and not be happy. You
or
can't,
do
you
the
cannot
Carlton.
Dance. You just have to move your body.
You have to do the Carlton to it, though.
Yeah.
What movie used this as a joke, but starring Tom Jones? Was it like one of the Naked Gun films or something where...
Oh, I don't remember.
This song was a punchline anyways. I just had that flash.
It's got to be Awesome Powers.
He was amazing.
Maybe that's
he's still alive.
I bet that's what it is. I bet it was an Awesome
Oh, he is amazing.
I also think it's one of those songs that like transcends the era completely.
Yeah.
Obviously, because it's still used all the time.
And it must, those things that have just become registered trademarks, it's hard to try to figure out what it must have been like to hear it when it was new.
I can't imagine. I wish I could hear it.
All right, Oliver, what's your 1965 jam?
So this is the only real chart topper that I put onto the that Spotify playlist of 65 I mentioned before. And it was Sam Cooke's last major hit, mostly because it was a hit after he died at the end of 1964. I mean, I've certainly heard it before it was used as the song, the kind of penultimate song that you hear in Malcolm X, the movie, before X is assassinated. It became a song that was covered by a lot of Cook's contemporaries after Cook's death, partially as an homage to him. And to me, thinking about the song's role and the way in which reflected the civil rights movement and just of the general tenor of this moment in the 1960s and in America around the world, change is going to come. It's ostensibly, on some level, supposed to be a hopeful song. It's about how change is going to come, that it's we just have to wait and it'll come forth. But it's also a song to me that's just suffused in death and tragedy. And there's a beautiful terror to it, or maybe a terrible beauty to it, that every time I hear it, it still just gets me right in the gut, because there's just so much weight and pathos to this and beauty at the same time. So Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come.
Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die.
That integration of sort of the emotional technology of the blues, of sort of like using music to manage emotions and get through shit, is just so awesome brought to a time like 1965. Mm-hmm. I was very much assuming that my 65 jam would be something very girl groupy. I looked through the Supremes and I realized, as I said, the Supremes that I loved happened in 67, 68. It's great stuff back then. I was pretty sure that Martha and the Vandellas were going to be my thing, because they're great. And then I realized that Rubber Soul came out in 1965, which is an album I have a very strong relationship with. I love all of those songs. They're all really great. But the song I'm Looking Through You is like... It's a song you don't hear very much. It's a I'm out of love song. And it's so witty. It's so sharp. But then it's also integrating this sort of like very mid-60s, like freak out dance party kind of thing to it, that's really charming. Let's hear some of it. But just the whole notion of a song that is like, no, you're not different, but every like your tricks mean nothing to me now. And then also the way that like Rubber Soul, I don't know if it is the first Beatles album where they've got the sitar, but like it is this beautiful, interesting moment for like cultural appropriation that we didn't know to call cultural appropriation. I mean, like, I have trouble with the concept of cultural appropriation. I think arts need to learn from each other, but there is something just so sort of like, let's snag this thing as half a gimmick and half something we respect. And Oliver's making facial expressions.
One thing if they were trying to make a song that sounded like an Indian raga, but
right.
I think using a sitar in your song doesn't, to me, really rise up to the level of busting out the CA term on them just because,
yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking back to Beach Boys. I mean, this 1965 is the era. It's not quite Pet Sounds yet because that's another year or two away. But Brian Wilson is fucking with incredible stuff in the studio just because he wants to make stuff sound different. Phil Spector's doing the same thing in places like Gold Star and Hollywood.
Exactly.
The sitar was like some interesting sounding shit.
And it's all about like who does it well. If they do it really well. Right. Like,
and it's reflective of looking at a world outside of yourself. You know, like they're not just existing within sort of the musical traditions that are expected. It is... understanding and respecting a thing that would have just been sort of like denigrated by much of the society that they lived in.
Oh, just worth noting that Rubber Soul came out in December of 1965, so 50 years almost to the day.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Nice.
And then the next year would be Revolver, and that's what I think you're thinking of with like the complete transference into like psychedelic, sitar-saturated, like trippy music.
But Norwegian Wood is just giving you so much lovely sitar.
Oh, it's yes.
Really lovely. Well, we've talked a lot, but you guys, we got named one of the 20 best new podcasts on iTunes, so thanks to all of you for making that possible, because we really appreciate your support, your active participation in the Facebook page, and you telling other people about us.
And we need to acknowledge that Margaret just turned 40 just the other day.
Wow!
I'm sorry. That's a big deal.
So what? Inappropriate. Oh,
this is Los Angeles. We don't say that in public.
Oh, God. It's a good age.
Guys 42.
Fuck you. I'm 40.
And by the way, don't even fucking talk about me, my age ever in life.
You're like, what, 22, right? Okay,
yes,
it's all good.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. You've been listening
Holy
to Pop Rocket.
Fuck.
They've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Wang. We'll post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Azimizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Endian Omni, Tyler McCormack, and LaVibo Wem 3090 for the 5-star reviews on iTunes and the great names. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join our Facebook group. Tell us who is your favorite Beatle and why. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are the now returned Colin Anderson and the ever helpful Christian Duenas. And I'm 27.
I'm 43. Loving it. I own that shit.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.